Hey, good morning, everyone. My name is Mark Bruce. I'm the Communications Director from the Ohio Department of Agriculture. Thank you very much for joining us here today on this conference call to discuss water quality. We're in Cleveland for the Midwest Association of the State Departments of Agriculture annual meeting. And so this is just an excellent opportunity to get the leaders of these Departments of Agriculture from Ohio, Michigan, and Indiana together to talk about how these states are collaborating, working together with private entities, public entities, farmers, everybody, to address the issue that is on a lot of minds all across the Midwest and the country, for that matter, and that's water quality. So with us today, Dave Daniels is the director of the Ohio Department of Agriculture, Jamie Clover Adams, the director of the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, and Ted McKinney is the director of the Indiana Department of Agriculture. So we're going to let the directors make a short opening statement, about 5 to 10 minutes, and then we will open the floor to questions. Reporters, we'd ask you to identify yourself before you ask a question, and then please address the question to someone. If you'd like it for multiple directors, please make that known as well. If you're with us on Facebook Live, please send in your questions, and we will try to answer those as best we can in the time that we have today. So, Director Clover Adams, if you'd like to open us up.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. I think I want to start with pointing out that probably what everyone knows, the Western Lake Erie Basin is a very complex biological system, and the health of the lake is affected by many things: wastewater treatment, septic systems, invasive species, and also food production. So there's really no one thing that's completely responsible for what we face, but we all need to do our part. And today, my colleagues and I will focus on what farmers and agriculturalists have done, are doing, and will do to do their part to improve the health of Lake Erie. I'd also like to point out that our work in the three states didn't start with the event in August of 2014 in Toledo. Our work started many, many years before that. In Michigan, we started in the River Raisin. It is a sub-watershed of the Western Lake Erie Basin. We have 23,000 acres of buffer strips installed, and we have reduced the total phosphorus load in that basin. We calculate approximately 20 to 30% reduction there. We also in Michigan started the Michigan Agriculture Environmental Assurance Program in 1999. This is a voluntary environmental stewardship program. We have local technicians on the ground that work with farmers to identify environmental risks. They walk the farm. They help farmers figure out which practices, which management things they can do to reduce risk on each and every field. And then the farms are verified by my department. We go in and make sure that they have done everything that needs to be done. They're verified for 5 years, and then they can be re-verified. But it's important to note that to be re-verified, you must meet the new standards that were added or the updates that were added in that five-year intervening period. In 2012, we added 3 additional technicians in that basin. So we now have 8 people on the ground in that 3 to 4 county area working with farmers to put those voluntary practices in place. MEEP has led to 60,000 acres of land that are under nutrient management plans. And that's important because a nutrient management plan tells the farmer, it's their game plan for the year, of how much nutrient they're going to use, how they're going to put it on, when they're going to do it. It's just a guiding document to help them keep that nutrient on the land for use by the crop. Then, you know, the Toledo issue hit. Between then and now, Michigan, Ohio, and Ontario, our governors have signed a compact or an agreement to reduce phosphorus 40% in the next 8 years. We have continued to implement MEEP. We have an additional 86,300 acres under nutrient management plan for a total of nearly 150,000 acres of land. There are also intentional farmer-to-farmer conversations where farmers that are in the program are recruiting new farmers to belong to the program, and we have 252 verifications. The private sector, as was mentioned in the opening, is also very active in the basin, working with farmers through the 4R fertilizer metric. We don't have numbers on that because it is in the private sector, but it is ongoing. And then we finally have the RCPP, the Regional Cooperative Partnership Program. There we go. that is Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, where our farmers and our in the three states are working together for the health of the lake, and that is through the Farm Bill. And then going forward, research is a really important thing. We all know that phosphorus is part of the is the cause of the algal blooms in Lake Erie. We know how to keep total phosphorus on the land, but we don't know how some of the other phosphorus is making its way to the lake. We need to figure that out. We need to figure out how it's happening so we then can put together best management practices to address those problems. We're working together with USGS, Michigan State University, and Ohio State University on our edge of field research. We are developing a GIS tool that farmers can use so when the technician comes out to the farm, they can look at each field and figure out which management practice will work best for that field. And then finally, a tool called Enviro Impact. We developed working with Michigan State University to help farmers determine when's the best time to apply nutrients to a field and get it used by the crop. This is a state-of-the-art technology. It's a tool that will help farmers and promote best practices. We also look forward to working with Michigan State and all of our research partners to develop more tools that successfully address this issue. Now, I know many of you have questions about winter manure spreading in Michigan. And I want to just say that, in my opinion, it's a red herring. There is longstanding science that shows that it can be done safely. And it's important to remember, in our part of the basin, there are only 17 large animal operations. They have environmental permits. They are required to have 6 months of manure storage starting on December 1 each year. They really have no need to spread manure in the winter. Now, it does happen sometimes, and the data shows us in the last 2 years, there have been only four of these facilities that found it necessary to spread, and it was done on fields that science and research indicate are least likely for runoff. Frankly, if this was the only problem for Lake Erie, we'd do it right away, but we know that it won't work. Winter spreading is used by small livestock farmers, and there are very few mid-sized cattle farms in the basin, so we are talking about extremely small cattle farms. As I said, it can be done in a way that reduces environmental risk. Lake Erie is a complex biological system, and we all have to do our part. Farmers have, are, and will do what they need to do to reduce risk. It's important to remember they live in the basin, their families are in that basin, and they care about their community. They have a vested interest in improvement. They are better today than yesterday, and they will be better tomorrow than they are today. Moving forward, the state of Michigan is committed to reaching and hopefully exceeding our target for Western Lake Erie. Our domestic action plan that was released last week is intentionally designed around voluntary practices for agriculture because we know they are the most effective, the most efficient, and the most affordable way for our state and for our farmers to ensure participation and achieve results. Our plan aligns programmatically with the cooperative RCPP that we share with Indiana and Ohio, as well as our pact with Ohio and Ontario to reduce phosphorus 40% over the next 8 years. The flexibility of the plan provides Michigan with an exciting opportunity to monitor what's working, determine when and where strategies may require change, and ultimately accomplish our vision for improving the health and the quality of the Western Lake Erie Beecher. And with that, I'll turn it to Dave.
Thank you very much, Director Clover Adams. Before Director Daniels makes a statement, folks, if you're on the conference call line, please mute your phones, especially if you're listening to the Facebook Live as well. So if you're on the conference call line, please mute your phones, and you can open them back up right before we're able to answer questions. So now, Director Daniels.
Well, thanks, Mark, and good morning, everybody, and welcome to Cleveland for the MASDA meeting. We are so honored to have the ag directors and commissioners from the Midwest states in the United States here to talk about everything that deals with agriculture. And, of course, one of those things that we have all been struggling with, whether or not we live in the Lake Erie Basin or the Mississippi River watershed, is water quality. You know, agriculture and food production is the foundation of the state of Ohio. It contributes $105 billion worth of economic activity and one out of every seven jobs. It's important to Ohio and to the nation and to the world that we continue to be as productive as we possibly can and share that production and share that whole space with every other industry that's out there. And whether it's whether it's homeowners, people, residents. We want to make sure that we are part of a community and we're doing our part. Plant and animal health is the number one issue that we deal with at the Ohio Department of Agriculture, and we work every day with our partners, not only in the governor's office, the legislature, the General Assembly, private partners to support and undertake that mission. One of the key topics that we have been working on for my time as director of the Ohio Department of Agriculture is water quality. We've been working together with almost everybody that you can possibly think of to come up with solutions and work every day to improve water quality. Under the leadership of Governor Kasich, water quality will continue to be our number one issue. In Ohio, we have implemented one of the first fertilized certification programs in the United States. Anyone who applies a nutrient on 50 or more contiguous acres must be certified by September the 1st this year. So far, we have certified almost 16,500 farmers in the state of Ohio through this certification program. And one of the things that we know as a result of that is it's working. 93% of the people that are surveyed after they take the course, according to them, said that they learned something about nutrient management and environmental stewardship that they didn't know before they went in. And almost three-quarters of every farmer that comes in to take those classes understands and realizes that phosphorus runoff is a key component to water quality, and they're working hard not only on their operations but with the private sector as well to solve some of the problems that we're seeing. We have worked with our sister state agencies to develop a domestic action plan that contains phosphorus and sets a reasonable reduction of 40% by the year 2025. Some of the things that we're going to talk about today is the fact that we are all working together. While Ohio State and Michigan have probably one of the greatest sports rivalries that you'll ever see anywhere in the world, we are setting all those things aside to work together, not only our farmers that work not only in Ohio, Michigan, and Indiana, but also our universities, our private applicators and our commercial applicators that are out there. Since 2011, the state of Ohio has invested more than $2 billion in Lake Erie watershed to improve drinking water, to improve wastewater treatment facilities, to plant cover crops, install controlled drainage systems, and fix faulty septic systems within that basin. So as Director Clover Adams said earlier, this is not only agriculture, this is one of many contributing forms that comes in there, and we're working hard to make sure that we only address not only agriculture's piece of this, but everybody else as well. Also in Ohio, we have just launched the new agricultural stewardship verification program. And this is a voluntary program that farmers will sign up for that is verifiable. It will allow them to apply if they meet certain criteria to be a certified farm. And part of that is that they'll have a nutrient management plan, that they are employing best management practices on their operation. It's a pilot program that we're working on that is going to be in Henry and Wood County in Ohio within the western basin of Lake Erie. And we hope that if that pilot goes well, we're able to expand that into the rest of the state. While we talk about the problems that we face or the difficulties that we face in the western Lake Erie Basin, we also face challenges in the Ohio River watershed as well. But hopefully this is an important step forward. And one of the things that we have done as the state of Ohio is look to other states to see what they're doing. And I think that one of the things that we can talk about and in a way of collaboration and who we're working with is the Michigan Meat Program that they have that is their environmental stewardship program. We've worked and taken some of their best ideas and incorporated that into ours. We have also launched the Ohio Applicator Forecast Tool. We've been working with the National Weather Service, and it's a tool that everybody can use, whether they're applying fertilizer or nutrients on thousands of acres, whether they're applying fertilizer on their garden or pesticides on their garden. This is something that works down to the field level, and it allows for a seven-day forecast. It takes into account snow cover, daily melt, soil saturation, so a farmer can look or an applicator can look and see what's the optimum time to apply those nutrients, because not only does he want to do it at the right time, he wants to make sure that he gets the benefit out of every dollar he spends on his property. But, you know, some of the other things that we talk about is our cover crops in the state of Ohio are growing in popularity. Almost 54,000 acres now have got cover crops growing on them in the wintertime. We've gone from just a few to almost 900 controlled drainage structures here in the state. We have built 50 new manure storage structures, and almost 34,000 acres of farmland has been converted into filter strips and riparian buffers near creeks and streams. Another 6,800 acres have been converted to wetlands. So as we look at where Ohio is, what we're doing, how we're working with our partners, not only across state lines and across international borders, but also with our environmental research teams that work at our public universities, our private sector, I think that we show that agriculture wants to be a part of the solution to the problems that we face, and I think that they have been very quick to react and put their best foot forward. So, Mark, with that being said, I'm going to allow you to pass the torch on.
Thank you very much, Director Daniels. Appreciate that. Thank you for muting your phones. It sounds a lot better in the conference call, so we appreciate that. Now I'll introduce Director Ted McKinney from Indiana. Ted?
Well, thanks very much, and I tell you, I just am thrilled to be here with you, Director Daniels, and Director Culver-Adams, because one of the joys about what we're doing in Indiana is the incredible collaboration with the two other states, the many universities, the many agencies, so thank you as well. I want to share just a few points. If you look at a map, you'll see that Indiana does not have shoreline on the western Lake Erie Basin, but it most certainly has four watersheds that feed into it. So we're all in. There's no walking on the part of Indiana as we step up to do our part to help address these problems, and glad to do that. Specifically, all or part of six northeastern counties of Indiana would feed into those watersheds. So the majority of the state would move down toward the Ohio Basin or a very small to Lake Michigan, but those six counties are very important. In fact, I'll add that we have more resources in those six counties than anywhere else in the state, reflecting the priority we've placed. And that's not just been something in the last year or two. That's been over a number of years. The point being, this is not a new issue that we in ag, and I think the same goes for those of you in other states, but just something that we're ongoing and continuing to ramp up. Let me share with you a few data points that might help you. In Indiana, we use a very conservative model provided by Region 5 EPA. And into that model, we input every practice that either the NRCS or our state employees or the local soil water conservation district people would perform. So think of a cover crop acreage going in. Think of a grass swale. Anytime a government employee would instill that or implement that, we manage that. And we now have the evidence to say that since 2014, we have more than doubled the number of quote-unquote practices, and we're thrilled, and the data will show it. For example, we're measuring reductions or the retention on the land of three things. First is sediment, and we know that we've doubled, a little more so since 2014, of the tons of sediment that we have retained on the soil. A little over 23,000 tons up to just shy of 50,000 tons. The same goes for phosphorus. We have doubled, a little more than doubled, from about 28,000 pounds to a little more than 60,000 pounds retained on the soil. Nitrogen is the same story, almost 56,000 pounds, more than doubled up to a little over 122,000 pounds. And the joy of that is that based on a transect that we perform annually in the state, we know that for every acre or every acre of practices that we're installing, farmers are doing it on their own at four to five times that number. So when I say conservative, those numbers are very, very conservative. As far as new items in Indiana, we're thrilled that our governor, lieutenant governor, and legislature appropriated new funds for the first time in years to add emphasis, and that emphasis was squarely in that northeastern Indiana, western Lake Erie Basin watershed. I can tell you on the regional applications, Director Smoove, that you mentioned, more than 300 applications have been submitted for a variety of conservation programs. Our Office of the Indiana State Chemist, which regulates fertilizer pesticides in Indiana, has instituted an enhanced and ongoing fertilizer certification training. And one practice and program that we've instituted in Indiana is a program called the Infield Advantage. Now, what is that? We recognize that there are many farmers who are already participating with conservation practices. But we're always trying to reach out and bring into the fold new and different farmers. And that's what this Infield Advantage program does, where we gather them. They're self-founded, formed oftentimes by a farmer, sometimes by Purdue, sometimes by our own agencies. And we're reaching not only new farmers, but significantly new acres of people who have their heart in it but may not have gone that extra mile. And so we're very, very pleased with that. In northern Indiana, we're blessed to have real diversity, and we have what is at least the second or third most populous concentration of Amish. Well, Amish are terrific people, but aren't prone to following some of those same practices. And we're now very successful in finding our way through the bishops and the others to get into those communities and help them start in their own way implementing those practices. And that's very important because a great deal of the Amish are in that western Lake Erie basin. I think one of the things that we're also most proud of is really something that our colleagues in the other states have been going very actively with, and that's the four R's. As it turns out, most of our ag, chemical, fertilizer retailers have been doing something like this, but they haven't been telling their story, and it hasn't been branded under the 4Rs program. So for those that don't know what the 4Rs program is, it's really the right product, the right rate, the right place, and the right time, so that we really dial in the right nutrients, which are necessary. They are necessary for cropping, but it's dialed in a much, much more accurate way. I would say again that, like you, we're an active part of that tri-state Western Lake Erie Basin Phosphorus Reduction Initiative. You know, we beat up on the feds quite a bit, but I want to compliment EPA and even USDA and the funding that they have allotted on a regional basis. And if there's ever a region, a tri-state region, it's this Western Lake Erie Basin where I think those dollars have gone to great value and to very, very good use. Last, and I'll just leave with a key point, that we're thrilled that through all the work by our farmers and various others over the last many, many years, we're lucky that Indiana is number two in the nation in the acres of cover crops. We're a little over 1 million acres, second only to a small state in the Southwest called Texas, and we're going to continue to grow that. And again, our greatest joy is that notwithstanding that we as government are helping facilitate that through cost share and encouragement, the data is showing that 4 to 5 times the number of acres that we're recording in our models are done by farmers on their own. And I think that's a powerful statement for those that may not know or be aware of, or perhaps unfairly accuse farmers of not participating as they should. I think the data would show quite the opposite. So thanks for the opportunity to share this, and we'll be happy to entertain questions as our moderators would direct us.
Thank you very much, Director McKinney. All right, reporters who are on the phone, if you have questions, now's the time to ask them. Please identify yourself before you ask your question, and if you have a specific director who you'd like to answer the question, please direct it toward them. If it's a question for the group, please make that known as well. So we'll go ahead and open it up to anyone on the line who has a question.
Director Daniels, this is Danny Eldridge with Hannah News Service. Do you have an idea of where we are in phosphorus reduction? I know it's, you want to be to 40% by 2025. Have we measured any reductions up to this point? I know it's only been a couple of years.
Go ahead, please.
And I was just going to say, and then in the future, are there benchmarks that we're going to be measuring to see if we're on the way to 40%?
Well, thanks for the question, Danny. Right now, we're still a little unsure about where we're at as far as reductions are concerned, because Ohio EPA has begun to put in monitoring stations. We really didn't have a good baseline to begin with, but we've started to develop those. Now, I can tell you that we got some information the other day from Chickasaw Creek watershed that looks extremely promising. They've had some monitors in, that's down in the Grand Lake watershed, but they've had monitors in a little sooner, and we've got some baseline information. The data, as we've seen it roll in, looks promising. We're going to continue to set up those monitoring stations, develop those baselines, but we believe that there's going to show that there has been a reduction in phosphorus in those streams and watersheds. And as far as our benchmarks to continue, obviously we've got our 40% reduction by 2025, and the EPA and other state agencies are working on our collaborative that'll establish those benchmarks for us.
Okay.
Next question.
Hello there. This is Jacob Kanzler, a reporter with MERS News in Lansing. My question is for Director Clover Adams. Can you respond on the criticism that the Michigan draft action plan doesn't do enough to address the threat of algal blooms? I know you mentioned the fertilizer application and also the value of voluntary ag programs. These groups seem to think that have different opinions on both of those. I want to see if you wanted to address some of the criticisms of how far the plan goes to combat algal blooms.
Great. Thank you, Jacob. I appreciate the question and the opportunity. I think I start by saying something I think you and I have talked about before, but we all know that when government issues permits, people do the minimum amount that's necessary. I kind of liken it to when you go to the doctor and they tell you you need to go to the gym or you need to work out. If the doctor gives you a list and says you need to, you know, walk a certain amount and you need to lift weights, that's all you're going to do. But if the doctor says you need to do this, here are some suggestions that work. Go to the gym and try it out. You're going to push yourself. You're going to find out you like it, and it may be swimming or whatever it is, and you're going to do more than you would have done if the doctor had just told you what to do. Farmers are the same way. If you have a permit, you're going to do just what it says. But if you're doing it on a voluntary basis, you're making changes that make sense on your farm, that achieve results, you're going to do more, and it's going to spur innovation. And the other thing in the ag community that people sometimes forget, these are businesses that are handed down from generation to generation. I know in my own family, you know, my dad does things the way that his dad did them. And my sister does things the way dad did them. And so when dad or the person running the farm changes the way they do things, the future generations continue to do them that way and make innovation and make change. So I do believe we do not have enough money in government to issue permits or, you know, stringent regulation that's going to get the job done. And it really is about getting the job done, not about what regulations. And you have to wonder, people are always saying that we need to ban winter spreading when there are only 17 CAFOs in the basin. There are very few mid-size operations. So there really isn't much of it going on, and it makes you wonder what their real agenda is. So I think that our domestic action plan hits the mark. It's continuous improvement, it sets benchmarks, and we'll be able to measure whether or not we're making progress. And I think, frankly, the proof's in the pudding, and we'll see when we get there the changes that have been made and the advancement that has been made for the health of the watershed.
Okay, thank you. Really quick follow-up question before the subject changes. You mentioned those points, but then just an overarching criticism was that the plan lacks concrete detail on how to reduce dissolved phosphorus runoff. I mean, isn't that the point of the plan? I mean, what's kind of the basis to make that criticism against the plan?
Well, you know, Jacob, I think that's a really good point, and Director Daniels hit on it as well as Director McKinney and I. We don't really know why that is happening, and it is going to require research. And that's why our department is working with USGS, Ohio State University, and Michigan State University on edge-of-field research. It's going to start this fall, and it's going to tell us why, how is this happening? And then we can design with the university's best management practices to reduce that risk. So, you know, potentially it's a fair criticism, but when you don't know why things are happening or how they're happening, you can't design practices to address that problem. So we will get there. And the other thing we point out, Jacob, in the plan is it's a continuous improvement. It's a, you know, we're going to learn things, we're going to measure, and we're going to adjust. And so we're not going to put in place a plan that says we're going to do A, B, and C for the next decade, because we're going to need to have some flexibility to adjust as we learn.
Okay, next question.
This is Celeste Baumgartner with FarmWorld. This is for the group. I've heard the criticism often that there are so many small farms that do not qualify as CAFOs, and therefore do not come under the regulations of CAFOs as far as manure applications and certifications and so on, that they can still cause quite a bit of damage. Does this ever come into discussion?
This is Ted McKinney, and thanks for the question. That's a common question, and it's a fair one, and that is, you know, does size make a lot of difference? In our experience, it's not necessarily so. There can be very, very good actors and less so at any size and scale. Our view, our approach in Indiana, and I think it's shared in our other states here that are represented here on the call, is that we're taking a holistic approach. I mean, when we invite farmers to be part of the Infield Advantage program, when we are promoting conservation practices, we're size neutral. We're going to go after whoever we think can participate and participate with sincerity and earnestness. So we haven't seen that. I would say, though, the converse to your question, what we've heard mostly is that the large CAFOs are to blame. Boy, I sure have not seen that. I think they're the ones who, at minimum, have a greater spotlight on them. Oftentimes can afford and do invest in those storage containers to allow for greater flexibility and timing of, in your case, I think the question is more livestock waste. So I would say we're getting after it across the board. Size makes no difference.
And thank you, and Celeste, thanks for the question. One of the things that we continue to look at is while our large animal operations are under permit, there are also laws and regulations that smaller producers have to abide by that we monitor through our local soil and water conservation districts. And those pollution issues are out there. So when we find somebody that is doing the wrong thing, that is applying in Ohio, whether it be on frozen and snow covered or over applying or applying too close to a ditch that causes a problem, I mean, we go out and actively seek enforcement against those folks. So while the large permitted facilities are under one series of regulations, there are still guidelines and regulations that those smaller operations continue to have to follow.
Yeah, and Celeste, this is Jamie. I would add, too, in Michigan, it's very similar. Our laws basically say if you discharge, you have a permit, and it doesn't matter if you have one cow, 50 cows, or 1,000 cows. If you discharge, you have to have a permit. And our, you know, as Director McKinney said, our meat program also is size neutral. It doesn't matter. We want to work with everyone of all sizes. The program is meant for everyone, and it does help them implement good management practices. And then finally, in Michigan, we have a very strong right-to-farm law, but part of that right-to-farm law is good practices to get that protection. and these kinds of activities are not allowed under those. So if you want to continue to have nuisance protection, you need to apply by what we call the GAMPS, and that would preclude that kind of behavior.
Thank you all.
Thanks, Celeste. Next
Ellison.
Question.
This is Garrett Ellison at MLive. This is a question for the group. You've each outlined the things that your states are doing to work towards watershed health in Western Lake Erie Basin. I was just wondering how you reconcile all that with the fact that it doesn't seem to be making much difference in the health of the lake. The blooms are still quite bad every year. They're record-setting as of a couple years ago, and it seems to be pretty bad this, or forecast to be quite bad this year. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk about we're doing this. We have voluntary practices that have been in place in since 1999. We're with this program, we have that program. Why is it not working?
Garrett, this is Jamie. I would say that one thing we need to remember is these problems didn't start yesterday. And they're not going to be solved tomorrow. This is a long-term problem. If you look at Lake Erie historically, there was a bloom problem back in the 70s and into the 80s. And then it went away and it came back. This is an ongoing problem. It's a very shallow lake. I don't think that enough has been done to look at what the impact of invasive species has had on the lake, the clearing of the water, the ability of the sunlight to penetrate down further. That's not excuses. That's just to say that there are a lot of complex things going on, and it's not going to, change is not going to happen overnight. We have data to show that we are making an impact, that we are improving. Do we need to do more? Yes, we do need to do more, but it's not going to change tomorrow. It's going to change, you know, 10, 15 years from now. This is not something that we deal with in the short run. This is long-term, robust change that has to happen to make a difference.
And I think it's also important to point out that, you know, there. I think there are some other things that come into play. The environment and Mother Nature certainly has a piece of this. We've seen some larger rainfall events in the past several years than we ever have. I would ask you to go back to last year, when the lake water was as clear and we had as clear a lake as we've seen in a long, long time. So, you know, as we continue to try to figure out how to make all this fit together, I always kind of likened it to a Rubik's Cube. There are 20,000 different combinations that we're working with trying to come up with this solution to keep this nutrient on our fields and out of the lake and keeping with the environment that we've got to deal with throughout the course of the year.
I'm sorry, did you, you mentioned larger rainfall events. So does that mean you think that extreme weather and perhaps climate change is playing a factor here?
I think there's no doubt that we've seen a difference in our weather patterns over the course of the last several years. We've talked about some of the larger rains that we have had. And we've talked about the fact that we might see warmer lake temperatures in the last year or so than what we've seen previous. Whether that's a pattern that continues on or whether that's cyclical, those are always things that that we can continue to look at. It's a very popular saying, in Ohio, if you don't like the weather, stick around for 4 hours and it's going to change. So, you know, we continue to try to deal with these, predicting the weather, predicting the amount of soil saturation that we've got when we're applying. So all those things are factors that we're trying to deal with, and we're trying to let producers out there in the field know this is how to best manage this when we've got 1,000 variables a day that we're working with.
Is climate change something that you're factoring into your programs at all?
I think that we're always looking at that, and we continue to look at the research that's going along not only with Ohio State, but obviously Stone Labs are looking at all the different things that are going on in the lake ecosystem as well. So, yes, we're looking at climate. We're looking at invasive species. We're looking at all different things that could be part of this and could be part of the solution to helping things out.
Okay, let's give someone else an opportunity to ask a question.
Gary Truitt from Hoosier Ag Today for Director McKinney. Indiana is unique in that we have a lot of different watersheds and a lot of different water shorelines and rivers as well, the Ohio River in the south, and we're, again, bordering on a lot of different states. What are you learning or can be learned from this initiative that will apply to other areas of the state and other relationships with, you know, Kentucky and Tennessee and Illinois and the other states, the Hoosier State borders?
Sure. Well, thank you for participating, Gary. Well, I would say the first thing we are learning is that when you do implement practices, and to the degree that you can measure it, and we are measuring it with that conservative Region 5 EPA model, you can at least tell a story that says agriculture is doing its share to get after the problem. I'd say that's the first thing, is measure it and you can see results. The second thing I'd say is that when you have an area that's a more concerted problem, and we're citing that today with the Western Lake Erie Basin, when you can add resources, it does help. And I was thrilled with our legislature, our governor, our lieutenant governor, for going the extra mile to add resources up there. But frankly, all these practices can be applied no matter where you are in any given state. You know, our southern third of the state is much more rolling, a little more like Kentucky than it is northern Indiana. And you can still use a grass swale. You can still and should be using cover crops. And so we're taking that portfolio or toolbox of practices and tailoring it to that farmer's needs, that farmer's soils, that farmer's practices. And we're bullish that it is making a difference. If you don't mind, Gary, I'm going to bleed back into the previous questioner, which said something about we're not seeing results. Well, this is a long-term thing. We have coached our farmers, and I think they have embraced that 1 year does not beget all the answers. This is a long-term play, and so we're going to stay very, very dedicated to that. But we're going to be applying every tool of the toolbox, no matter the soil type, no matter the farmer, to meet their needs.
Thanks, Gary. Next question.
Hi, this is Nicole Heslop with Brownfield Ag News. I'm interested in knowing from all of the states, what's the reaction from seeing the Great Lakes funding zeroed out in the Trump budget and long-term EPA funding, what kind of impact that's been able to have in the Great Lakes?
Well, thanks, Nicole. And I, you know, we've talked about this quite a bit. Yes, we're hearing a lot out of Washington, and we're hearing a lot about their budget and their process. I continue to tell people, let's not get too excited about it. There's a lot of that budget football game left to play. I think that obviously it's difficult to deal with hypotheticals. I think that we're going to see some funding. I hope that we do. I think that people and the legislators, not only in Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, and not only there, but all across the United States, recognize that this is a problem that we need to continue to work with. Our partners at NRCS have always been good. The RCPP money that Director Clover Adams spoke about a little bit ago have put a lot of programs on the field, or put a lot of programs in place. I also believe that what we're seeing is the results of some of those dollars that are coming in. Farmers are beginning to change their practices on their own and fund those out of their own pockets because they see benefit to them as far as nutrient capture, soil health. All those things are beginning to play in. So while we continue to hope that there's a robust appropriation for the Great Lakes region, we continue to say that a lot of the work that we've done over the last several years is beginning to see those farmers pick up those practices and carry them on their own.
This is Ted McKinney, and I would endorse that same point. I'll remind you that our annual transect, which is statistically significant, would tell us that for every acre that USDA provides in funding, that's through the Farm Bill program, that another 4 to 5 acres are being planted without cost share. So sure, we do see the value in the federal funding, no doubt about it. We would support that. We'd support its continuation. But that doesn't mean that we in Indiana, and I dare say the same for my colleagues in Ohio and Michigan, that does not mean we'll be stopping in any way, shape, or form. We're seeing success.
And I think the last thing I'd add, Nicole, is that I think the thing that you've heard from all of us today is there's a lot of measurement here. We know what we're getting. And I think with this administration and with Congress, if we can show that there's value, that there's return on investment to that money, and in agriculture we can, I think we'll be successful in getting those funds coming to the Great Lakes for water quality initiatives.
Thank you, Nicole. Next question.
Hi, this is Tyler Scott from Michigan Radio. This question is mainly for Director Clover Adams, but if the rest of you would like to weigh in, I'd be interested to hear as well. Director Adams, you said there's a lot of more research that needs to be done. I'm wondering how much of a priority is more research to figure out more of the things that we just don't know about what's going on here, and like, is more funding needed, or where should we be looking as a source of more information just about this whole complex issue?
Thank you, Tyler. I appreciate the question. Specifically in the ag arena, through several measures that our legislature took a couple years ago, we have over $1 million available of state funds. And those are not general funds. Those are fees paid by farmers that will be available for the research. USGS is matching some of that money, and then Michigan State University and Ohio State are also putting in researchers and other funds. So we've been able to pull together the money to do that. I think once we start learning from that, then we're going to need to look at what resources are needed. So say we figure out or we find out how dissolved reactive phosphorus is leaving the field, then the step will come of doing the research of what practices help keep that on the land and available for the plant. And at that point, we may need additional money for those that research activity. But right now, we have the amount that we do need, and we look forward to moving forward this fall.
Tyler, I might also mention, why there is additional money in Ohio going into research and other things. I think another thing to point out is that, you know, we continue to hear all the time that you know, you've had years to do research. Well, let's face it, research projects on the collegiate level and on the academic level take a long time, not only to gather data, to gather information, to formulate hypotheses that come off of that, but also all of our institutions, whether it's Heidelberg, whether it's Michigan, whether it's Ohio State, they've all got different programs going on, and I think that sometimes we need to work on coordinating and combining a lot of that information that our public universities have got, Stone Lab as well, all those people that have got some sort of a water quality research program going on as in Indiana as well, need to bring that in so that, you know, as we get that, we need to continue to work on coordination so that we can get that best management practice message out to our producers.
Okay, next question.
Yeah, this is Cynthia Price from the Grand Rapids Legal News. And Director Clover Adams, I appreciate your talking about the process for the edge of field research. I was actually going to do a follow-up question with that. But the main thing that I am wondering, because my approach will be kind of statutory to this article, is if you know what the status is of the process of getting Lake Erie watershed designated impaired. And I also wondered about, obviously after Michigan, so in particular Director Clover Adams, but the others as well, what your opinion is about how that will help you out in terms of resources, et cetera.
Thank you, Cynthia. I really appreciate it. As a practical matter, I don't think whether or not Lake Erie is declared impaired really makes a difference for what we're doing. In Michigan, we chose to do that. But we all knew, you know, as we talked about, many of us, that we're doing things well before the event in Toledo in 2014, and we will continue to do them. Farmers see the need. They see what's happening in the lake, and they want to be a part of the solution. So I really, at this juncture, don't think as a practical matter it really matters one way or the other. You know, the governor signed a 40% reduction with Ohio and Ontario. We have work going forward. We have our domestic action plan working with EPA. We would have done that regardless, so I really don't think that it makes that much difference.
Okay, let's take another question. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to follow up and ask, you know, kind of like the previous questioner asked, you know, do you think that that designation might come with resources? I mean, I know, for example, the Areas of Concern program it abruptly a few years back came with a lot of additional resources, and that was kind of what I was wondering as well. Thank you for your answer.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Cynthia. That's a very good point. It may, but you want to remember that it's not. It's Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, New York, Pennsylvania, who are all going to be working on improving the health of Lake Erie. You know, if it's been our experience that when we see a problem, what the legal standing is, I don't think really plays into or plays that much into whether or not resources are put to a problem.
Thank you.
Okay, another question?
Yeah, this is Tyler Scott from Michigan Radio again. I'm just wondering about for people who aren't in the agriculture community, who aren't farmers or anything like that, and if they were to hear, like, there's a lot we don't understand about this issue, I mean, what is it we know at this point about the things that are affecting Lake Erie's Western Basin, and what do we know that we don't know, and, yeah, I mean, where we are in just understanding the basic problem as it is?
Tyler, I guess what I would say, we know that it is a complex problem and that there are many contributing factors. We know that wastewater treatment affects, you know, discharges affect. We know that septic tanks have an impact. We know that invasives have an impact. The one that I know the most about and my colleagues do as well is agriculture. And we know that we have been good in the past of keeping what we call total phosphorus on the land, because we've always known in agriculture that if you bind that nutrient to the soil, if you keep for regular people, the dirt on the land and don't have it wash into the stream, you're going to keep the nutrients on the land. What we're seeing is that what we have held as a truth for decades may not be the case in every situation. And so we're seeing something they call dissolved reactive phosphorus. So somehow that phosphorus is not binding to the soil. And that's where the research, figuring out why, how it's happening and why it's happening, so that then we can come up with management practices. So we know some things. But there's a lot we don't know, and we're trying to figure that out.
Okay, we have time for one last question. Any takers?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, this is Dimitri Shapiro from the Adrian Daily Telegram, and every conversation I've had recently, and I'm kind of new on the subject, has said that Canada was a big, big player in this area. And I was wondering, it had been mentioned once, I was wondering what the situation is with Canada, what kind of deals there are, how it is to work with them, what they have in place to protect against their phosphorus runoff. And this is for all three.
Well, Dimitri, thanks for the question. I think one of the things that we say is, you know, we've got, this is not only a U.S. and multi-state problem, but an international problem. Several months ago, probably just about a year ago, several groups came together, including Ontario, and signed the collaborative agreement and the agreement that we would, as a collective group, reduce phosphorus going into the Western based on the Lake Erie by 40%. So they have been on board with us and continuing to work not only between our states, but between our national governments as well. One of the things that I'd kind of like to say is, and this is just kind of as a matter of course, we're three different states and a province in Ontario, and we're all doing something different. There are hundreds of soil types in the state of Ohio. There are hundreds of different kinds of topography, not only in Ohio, but across Michigan, Indiana, Ontario. And all those things are allowing each one of us to put together a different program that solves or hopes to solve the same problem that we've all had. So again, I continue to say that while Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan have worked very closely, our partners to the north of us, our international partners, have done their part as well and continue to work closely with us.
Okay. Now, we had two really polite reporters because one reporter let somebody else go first. So, whoever said that last time, if you want to ask your question, go right ahead. We have time for one more here.
Thanks. That's Garrett Ellison at MLive again. I wanted to get back to something that, Jamie, you mentioned regarding winter application of manure. You called it a red herring. I know that Ohio has placed some pretty severe restrictions on that. So, Dave, do you share Jamie's opinion that the application of manure on saturated, frozen, or snow-covered ground is a red herring? Because it seems like your state is policies that have been passed by your state don't match up with that.
Well, first of all, like I said, every state's got their own approach to everything. We don't believe that, any of us are doing something that is right, wrong, or better or worse. This is just the path that Ohio's taken. In the Western Lake Erie Basin, we've got, it's fairly flat topography up here. We believe that spreading manure on frozen and snow-covered ground is the best management practice is not to do that. We've asked farmers not to do that. We require that of our large permitted livestock operations. We decided to make that the standard practice for any size livestock operation. So we're just trying to make sure that all our operators are operating under the exact same set of rules, whether they're a large livestock operation or a small operation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone, for participating on the call today. Thank you to our directors for your answers and your commentary today. If you have any questions for your specific director or your agency, please follow up with your state contact. So you should have information with your local contact. Please follow up with them. Thanks very much for tuning in, and have a great Monday.